It is Monday, January 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, at least 11 people are killed in the latest suicide attack in Kabul, Afghanistan.
We do have to remember that this attack happened at a time when Kabul was already very tense.
Thousands march in pro-opposition rallies across Russia, and a new film offers a fresh perspective to the traditional Western. It's all ahead. Violence struck Afghanistan Monday as at least 11 members of the Afghan National Army were killed and 16 others wounded in an early morning attack on a military academy in Kabul. The attack occurred near the Marshall Fahim National Defense University. VOA's Pakistan and Afghanistan correspondent Aisha Tanzim describes to me the circumstances surrounding the attack.
So what we know from the spokesman of the Ministry of Defense in Afghanistan is that 4 to 5 suicide bombers were involved. The first two exploded their vests at the entrance, and then there were 3 more that tried to fight their way through. The Afghan National Army units fought back. They killed 2 more suicide attackers, and they actually arrested one with his vest intact. We know that more than 10 people have died, but many were critically wounded, so the death toll may go up. The Taliban, which were responsible or which took responsibility for the previous 2 attacks in Kabul, the Intercontinental and then the other ambulance bomb this weekend, they did not take responsibility for this one. Islamic State, through its official, what they call the Amaq News Agency, took responsibility for this attack. But we do have to remember that this attack happened at a time when Kabul was already very tense. On Saturday, there was the huge explosion that killed more than 100 people. On Sunday, the entire country had a day of mourning. On Monday, Kabul, there was a public holiday in Kabul just so the government could free up its resources and help the victims of the attack. So this is coming right in the middle of all of that. So the anger and the frustration are right now at a very high level.
Is it known why this violence has escalated so dramatically just within the last few days?
No one really knows why, and it is possible that as the weather is warming up a little bit, these attacks are happening as we usually see around springtime. But it is also possible that as Afghanistan and the United States grapple with its policy in Kabul and try to put pressure on Taliban, and they have put pressure on Taliban in other places in the country because they've significantly increased their airstrikes in various parts of the country. So it is possible that this is the Taliban fighting back and trying to show that despite that pressure, there's still a force.
Well, also on Monday, Indonesian President Joko Widodo is visiting Kabul, and he has also just visited Pakistan. I believe he has been in discussions with officials from both Afghanistan and Pakistan about how they and his representatives from his country perhaps can work towards easing some of this violence.
Yes. So Indonesia, of course, is the most populous Muslim country, and so it has significant influence. And the Indonesian president was in Pakistan. On Friday, he met a lot of senior leaders, and he was here for the weekend, and then he went to Afghanistan today for a day. And what he suggested was that a group of Islamic scholars from Indonesia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan sit together and kind of find a way, you know, and a solution to this problem through dialogue. But he suggested that this be a group of Islamic scholars rather than just regular politicians and negotiators and anyone else.
Does he think the scholars perhaps would get better results than the officials?
I think the perception in the region is that the people who are the perpetrators of the violence, the scholars may have more influence with them. So, for example, an Islamic scholar in Afghanistan might have more influence with those people than President Ashraf Ghani, whom a lot of Taliban think that he's there as a puppet of the American administration. So this is one theory. Whether it will actually work in real life or not is another thing altogether, because the Taliban, if they're doing it in the name of Islam, they also have their own scholar. Their current leader, Maulvi Hibatullah, is a jurist. He's a jurist. He was actually, people were bringing their cases to him to solve their cases according to Islamic jurisprudence. So it's not like they cannot come up with counter-arguments of their own.
VOA's Pakistan and Afghanistan correspondent Aisha Tanzim. She's reporting from Islamabad. Well, joining me now is social media editor Lori London with a look at what's trending. So, Lori, what's happening?
Well, apparently social media addiction is becoming very widespread. From games to social media networks, they're all designed to feed that addiction. And how about feeding that addiction with an app to cure you of it? Yes, there's now a growing market for apps that do just that. And the latest one is called Mute. It was launched for iPhone this month. Others include Space and Moment. Now, Mute tracks how often you open your phone and how much time you spend on it. And then when your screen time decreases, it praises you. Moment sets up daily limits on usages and tries to force you off the device by bombarding you with notifications. And Space helps you set goals to change the habits. So as the addictions grow, so do the number of apps looking to combat the problem. And the news really isn't all that bad. People are waking up to this social media, smartphone addiction habit, and they are trying to break free of it, as seen by again, by the growing demand for apps that help break the cycle. But before you go turning off your smartphone or logging off of social media, let's talk about something that is trending right now that will ultimately take your eyes off the screen and into the sky for a real-life show. Twitter is abuzz about an extremely rare celestial event coming this week, a supermoon trifecta. On January 31st, there will be a super blue blood moon. U.S. space agency NASA says it's three separate events colliding. A closer-than-usual approach of a full moon, which will be bigger and brighter, or a supermoon, while the lunar eclipse adds the blood, or that reddish hue, while passing through the Earth's shadow. It becomes reddish because the sun, Earth, and moon will be aligned perfectly. And because it's also the second full moon of the month, it's a blue moon. Thus the name, Super Blue Blood Moon. And by the way, it is so rare that the last time there was a Super Blue Blood Moon, which is also trending with the hashtag Super Blue Blood Moon, the last time was in 1866.
Thanks very much, Lori. That's social media editor Lori London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Al-Shabaab is blamed for the ambush and killing of a Somali military commander and three others. In Yemen, at least 12 people are killed as violence in Aden escalates. North Korea cancels a joint performance with South Korea at the Olympics. And Russia's team is banned from Paralympics Winter Games. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An Australian-led team of scientists found evidence that suggests coral has a greater chance of getting a disease if it comes into contact with plastic waste. The researchers say they studied more than 120,000 corals in and around Indonesia, Myanmar, Thailand, and Australia. The examined corals either had contact with waste plastic or no exposure to the material at all. The researchers found the chance of coral with disease increased from a rate of 4% without plastic contact to 89% when corals interacted with the waste material. While the team didn't find out specifically how plastic spread disease to coral, they did note that the material does provide an environment that encourages growth of microscopic organisms that could pass along disease should it come into contact with coral. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Music. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Bruno Mars is the top winner at the Grammys. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been released from police detention in Moscow after thousands of pro-opposition marchers rallied against a March election expected to extend President Vladimir Putin's term in the Kremlin. Police arrested Navalny while he was on his way to a rally in central Moscow. Thousands of protesters braved freezing temperatures to stage rallies in dozens of cities across Russia to protest what Navalny and his supporters call upcoming pseudo-elections. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. He describes to me how Navalny and his supporters are protesting the upcoming election.
They're calling for a voter strike, for a boycott of the election in March, with the idea that this can take some of the shine off of Vladimir Putin's victory, which nobody doubts. Everybody knows that Vladimir Putin will win this race. The question is, does he get it with the low voter turnout, which would suddenly make him look a lot less impressive to the Russian public?
The rallies that took place, the scale of this, did this come as a surprise to authorities?
No, I don't think so. If you go back over the past year, Navalny has proven, first of all, he's run a national campaign. And one of the ironies of this election has been that Navalny, the one candidate who really is actively carrying out what would look like an election campaign in many Western countries anyway, is the only candidate not allowed in the race, whereas the ones who have been sanctioned by the Kremlin to participate in this election don't really seem to be trying that hard. They're not getting out talking to voters. Navalny's carried out this. He's opened up campaign offices in cities across the country. And through his other activities, he's an anti-corruption campaigner. He's really tapped into some anger in the regions. You know, I think for a long time, Navalny was considered the sort of hipster candidate in Moscow, popular with the urban elites. And what he's shown through the past year is that he's connected with Russians, particularly younger Russians across the country. So you go to Sunday and prior rallies that Navalny has called, you know, he's had these have been carried out in several dozens, if not this time was over 100 cities across Russia. The issue, I think some people would argue, is the numbers. If last March, where he carried out a protest that brought tens and thousands of people out on the streets, in March, it was a nice day, it was sunny weather out in much of the country. You know, that really shocked, I think, the Kremlin. This time, there were only several thousand out, but of course, we had temperatures dipping into minus 30, minus 40 below in Siberia. So asking people to come and protest the government when it's that cold is definitely a tougher challenge.
There were also a number of young demonstrators who seemed to signal they are getting frustrated with Putin. I mean, he has been in leadership for much of their lifetime.
That's right. There's a whole generation, what they call Generation Putin, you know, that these are young people who've come out, they've grown up under Putin. But in a way, Putin is their parents' candidate. These are people who are maybe 17, 18, 19 years old. Their entire lives, their entire political lives have been surrounded by Vladimir Putin at the helm of the Russian government. And, you know, part of the problem with that is that they, you know, say, even some of them will say, you know, Mr. Putin did some good things, but it's just been too long. 18 years in power is too long. They want to see some change. A lot of them who are supporters anyway of Alexei Navalny will say they don't understand why, if Putin is so popular, and he is popular, if you go by polling here, they don't understand why they won't allow Navalny in the race to take him on in real competition. You know, if he's the stronger candidate, let him win. So there are a lot of questions there, but definitely you've seen Navalny connect with younger voters, and he's done it through social media. He runs a very effective YouTube channel and Facebook campaigns. And clearly this is something that's unnerved the Kremlin, because in some ways, Vladimir Putin, who is, you know, he's been the national leader now for going on 18 years, but he is 66 years old. Navalny is much younger. And there's a bit of an age gap there in a sense of who really understands how to harness the internet. I think that's certainly come across in this election as well.
Charles Maines reporting from Moscow. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Scott Cooper's Western, Hostiles, addresses the theme of reconciliation amid the racial divide between whites and Native Americans at the end of the 19th century. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with Native American actor Wes Studi about his role in the film and its message in today's America.
Captain, you do know Chief Yellow Hawk. The Army wants to be certain that the chief gets home to Montana safely without incident.
After years of brutal fighting between whites and Native Americans, Army Captain Joseph Blocker is told by his superiors to escort his dying mortal enemy, Cheyenne Chief Yellow Hawk, from New Mexico to his ancestral land in Montana. This political decision was made back east in Washington, D.C., following negative press reports about the treatment of Native Americans by the U.S. Army. Blocker has to obey.
I hate them. I got a war bag of reasons to hate them.
Christian Bale offers a powerful performance as the U.S. Army captain, legendary for his merciless attacks against the natives. Yet, despite his potential for savagery and unbridled rage, his character exudes a quiet dignity and stoic resolution.
Get her! Yes, sir. Unchain him.
Bale says Hostiles, a revisionist Western, departs from the traditional story where the cowboys are the good guys versus the bad Indians. Cooper's Hostiles looks at the human capacity for committing atrocities by both sides as they fight for survival in an inhospitable landscape.
There's a horror element to this. I think there's this kind of imprisonment that certainly I can say my character's feeling. And one at the same time, like the absolute beauty of this landscape and of America, but how it can be absolutely horrific at the same time when you've had so many friends die for this land.
Like many Westerns, Hostiles describes a physical as well as a metaphorical journey of a group of people from different backgrounds.
You believe in the Lord, Joseph?
A young white wife and mother who has just lost her entire family in a violent attack by Comanches. A soldier, deeply depressed over the atrocities he has committed. Another soldier, unrepentant over his part in savage murders. Still, the emphasis falls on the gradual reconciliation between the two mortal enemies, Captain Blocker and Chief Yellow Hawk, played by acclaimed Native American actor Wes Studi.
No, sir, it's
I think it's very accurate in that it's not a full-blown reconciliation. It's simply a matter of having a common foe. Not only the Comanche, but the weather, the land, the robbers, the fur traders.
Studi says these alliances have never quite bridged the divide between whites and Indians. Even today, he says, Native Americans are losing their lands to oil and mineral extraction.
Well, they've always been under threat, and now I think what's happening is that the larger American public is beginning to feel what we felt back in the day when genocide was the practice and colonialization was actually what was practiced.
Studi says the positive focus of Hostiles on reconciliation, redemption, and healing provides a cathartic outcome for the film. But audiences should not expect Native Americans to ever forget their treatment. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks very much, Penelope. Sounds like a very compelling film. Well, Bruno Mars was the big winner Sunday night at the 60th Annual Grammy Awards in New York, winning Album, Record, and Song of the Year. In accepting the top prize of Album of the Year for 24K Magic, Mars said there was just one overriding reason behind the songs on the album.
You know, those songs were written with nothing but joy, and for one reason and for one reason only, and that's love. And that's all I wanted to bring with this album, and hopefully I could feel that again and see everybody dancing and everybody moving.
Mars also won Grammys for Best R&B Album, Best R&B Performance, and Best R&B Song. In other categories, Alicia Cara won the Best New Artist Grammy, while rapper Kendrick Lamar took home Grammys for Best Rap Album, Rap Song, and Rap Performance. Well, meanwhile, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who lost the 2016 presidential race to Donald Trump, she made a surprise appearance in a pre-taped skit about people auditioning to be the voice for the spoken word recording of Michael Wolff's bestseller Fire and Fury, about Trump's first unconventional year in office. The skit angered Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, who tweeted she has always loved the Grammys, but she tweeted to have artists read the Fire and Fury book killed it. Donald Trump Jr., meanwhile, hit back at Clinton, tweeting that getting to read a hashtag fake news book excerpt at the Grammys seems like a great consolation prize for losing the presidency. Neil Portnoy, the head of the Recording Academy, the Grammys' parent organization, told the Associated Press that he thought Clinton's appearance was more satirical than political. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In January, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the creation of the Hezbollah Financing and Narco-Terrorism Team, or HFNT, a group of experienced international narcotics trafficking, terrorism, organized crime, and money laundering prosecutors. HFNT prosecutors and investigators are tasked with investigating individuals and networks providing support to Hezbollah and pursuing prosecutions in any appropriate cases. The HFNT will begin by assessing the evidence in existing investigations, including cases stemming from Project Cassandra, a law enforcement initiative targeting Hezbollah's drug trafficking and related operations. Acting Assistant Attorney General John Cronin of the Justice Department's Criminal Division will supervise the HFNT and will convene a coordination meeting focused on identifying and combating such support to Hezbollah. The HFNT will coordinate with, among others, investigators from the Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, including the DEA's Special Operations Division, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Homeland Security Investigations, Assistant United States Attorneys, and attorneys from the Justice Department's Criminal Division and National Security Division. The Justice Department will leave no stone unturned in order to eliminate threats to our citizens from terrorist organizations and to stem the tide of the devastating drug crisis, said Attorney General Sessions. In an effort to protect Americans from both threats, the Justice Department will assemble leading investigators and prosecutors to ensure that all Project Cassandra investigations, as well as other related investigations, whether past or present, are given the needed resources and attention to come to their proper resolution, he said. The team will initiate prosecutions that will restrict the flow of money to foreign terrorist organizations, as well as disrupt violent international drug trafficking operations. The investigation and prosecution of terrorist organizations that contribute to the growing drug crisis are a priority for this administration, said Acting Assistant Attorney General Cronin. At the Attorney General's direction, the HFNT will use all appropriate tools to aggressively investigate and prosecute those who provide financial support to Hezbollah in an effort to eradicate the illicit networks that fuel terrorism and the drug crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.